You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mary Gordon's latest book, The Liar's Wife, is a collection of four novellas about Americans in Europe and Europeans in America. The stories, although not connected to each other in an obvious way, all deal with issues of faith sustained or lost, father figures or mentors, and the power past events can have over the present. Mary Gordon is the author of six novels, three collections of stories, two memoirs, and several works of nonfiction. Her new book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show today. Hello.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Haven't writers always had difficulties getting novellas published because publishers think they're more difficult to sell than novels or even short story collections, which have their own problems?
Yeah, probably if it were my first book, I would have had a hard time getting it published. And I'm very grateful to Pantheon because they believe in literature still. They're really a good group of folks. And so I think because I had a track record, they let me get away with it.
And you have developed a loyal following that will buy a book that has your name on it. Well, what's the attraction of the novella form for a writer like you?
I think for me, if I create a novel, I have to create a world, a whole world, and a sort of very deep, rich outer background, which sounds like an oxymoron, but a world that really extends quite far. A novella allows me, at least, to stay with a character and one setting, which would be deep rather than wide. It's an exploration of character and plot that are longer than a short story. I think a short story is more like a poem.
So this could be more expansive, but Yes. It's not as digressive as a novel would
exactly.
be.
Exactly. And the amount of detail of the outside world doesn't have to be so great.
You've told all four of these stories in the third person, but from the point of view of the story's protagonists, each has a different voice. Did you consider writing them in first person?
I actually started the Simone Weil one in the first person, with a lot of it being from Genevieve's point of view in a journal. And then it just seemed too fake. For one thing, it occurred to me that a woman with a young baby wouldn't have time to keep a journal. So I gave that up.
I want to address this Simone Weil thing in just a moment. But in her rave review in the Sunday New York Times book review, Valerie Martin suggested it's important to read these novellas in the order in which you've presented them because of the way they build on one another. Did you write them intending to publish them together?
Yes, I did. I did. I always wanted to write about the fact that there's nothing about like being in Europe to make you realize how American you are. And sometimes in shocking ways,
sometimes in ways that
shame you.
I read the newspaper and I think, have they gone mad back home? And of course, when you're here, it's just part of everyday life.
Yes, but also things like in Italy, which I adore, if somebody says, I'll meet you at 7, it could mean any time between 7 and 2 a.m. And when you're there, it drives you crazy. And they're saying, well, what's the problem? I said 7. And that makes you feel that you're sort of American when you go to the post office and you expect it to be open when it's supposed to be open. You expect people to actually, it's one of the things that I deal with in The Liar's Wife, you expect people to mean what they say. And that doesn't mean the same thing from culture to culture.
The Liar's Wife is about a woman who bumps into her ex-husband who was a liar, but he thought he was just a good storyteller.
Well,
this is something that writers must think a bit about.
He also just wants to make people happy. And to him, it's more important for people to be happy and entertained than the truth. What is that? Whereas happiness is very palpable to him.
Valerie Martin also wrote in the Times that describing The Liar's Wife, these four novellas, as four novellas about Americans in Europe and Europeans in America suggests that the counterpoise between American innocence and European experience will once again be a fruitful subject. But the transatlantic interactions in these stories are minimal and have little to do with culture shock. The foreign country that disrupts the lives of Gordon's characters is the past. You must have liked that.
Yes, I did. It made me very happy. Because one always feels, oh, my God, Henry James did it. Why am I doing it? It seems a bit hubristic.
Well, the Innocents Abroad approach.
Yes, exactly. And I think what's interesting to me is how different Europe is in the imagination to young people than it was when we were young. It was, for us, the great good place. It was where you went to learn how to live. And it's not anymore. Everybody's wearing their baseball caps backwards, and everybody's looking at you know, American Idol. But for me, and I think for our generation, it was the place where real important life was lived. And
the food was better, and maybe it's not all that much better anymore.
That's true, because now that we're becoming obsessed with food.
Well, we're getting better and they're getting worse.
I think so, but not Italy. Italy is still fabulous.
You've included real people. You mentioned Simone Weil and Thomas Mann also in two of these novellas. Weil was a French philosopher, a political activist, and a Christian mystic who had converted from Judaism.
Oh, she didn't convert. She did not convert.
Well, there is a disagreement over it. I have read that a priest in Harlem said that or reveals that she was baptized.
No, I would absolutely go to my grave saying she was never baptized.
Okay.
Because she said she would not ever be baptized until the church revoked anathema sit. That is, saying that there were things that you believed that would... No, I absolutely...
Okay.
Leonard, I can arm wrestle you this for... the rest of the show, if you like.
I really am not that committed to Simone Weil, although you've said that you've been obsessed with her for some time.
Yes. She's so brilliant about human affliction and human suffering and the reality of what human suffering does to the human soul. And so absolutely malignantly obtuse about Judaism. She's a real self-hating Jew and ignorant about Judaism in a way that a brilliant woman, you know, you simply can't make sense of it. So it's her sensitivity to human suffering and her absolute insistence on putting her body where her mouth is.
Well, she died at 34.
She did.
Because she had tuberculosis, but she died, I think, of a heart attack or something like that.
She starved herself. She would only eat, she had TB and she needed to eat. And she would only eat what people could eat in France on rations. And so she, in fact, starved.
Even though she was out of France.
She'd in England, yeah.
She'd come here so that she could get to England and join the resistance. But you tell the story that includes her, Simone Weil, in New York, from the perspective, as you mentioned earlier, of a 24-year-old Genevieve Levy, who once studied under her at Lycée in France. And when your story opens in 1942, Genevieve's husband is overseas in the military, and she's living in a Manhattan apartment with her infant son and her brother. And she has mixed feelings about Simone Weil when she bumps into her.
Well, one of the things that I really wanted to write about is what happens when you grow out of your mentor. What happens when the person whom you adored and worshipped and based yourself on as a teenager suddenly seems no longer of use and perhaps even dead wrong? And that's a subject that interests me a lot. So Genevieve feels that everything that Simone Weil taught her no longer applies. It doesn't help, and it may not even be true.
She also remembers her as an extremely demanding teacher who was unwilling to accept compromise of any kind. And then she's embarrassed to tell Weil that instead of seeking some kind of greatness, she's leading an ordinary life as a wife and mother. So there's something wrong about that.
Well, not only is she a wife and mother, she's taking care of a very, very afflicted brother who is afflicted with cerebral palsy. So she just doesn't have time for the life of the mind because she's tending to the life of bodies.
I'm speaking with Mary Gordon, whose four novellas have been published under the title of one of them, The Liar's Wife. Did you see Thomas Mann as representing a very different kind of emigre from Hitler?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because what is amazing about Thomas Mann is he had everything to lose. He was absolutely at the top of the tree in Germany. He was German literature. And so for him to have the courage to expose Hitler, when he had been very supportive of Germany in the First World War, and he loved Germany, for him to do that was to give up incredible prestige, wealth, and safety to come over here. And what fascinated me was he went all over the country. Because remember, in 1939, America was very isolationist. He went everywhere he could and said, look, there's this man, Hitler. You got to pay attention. I was very moved by that.
Not that he was uncomfortable here. He lived in Pacific Palisades, a very nice area. But your story is told from the excuse me, the perspective of Bill Morton, a 90-year-old retired doctor who remembers being chosen in 1939 when he was an idealistic and impressionistic high school student to introduce the visiting Nobel laureate at a school assembly. And he remembers that day as the happiest in his life.
Yeah. I'm also very interested in a moment in which one meets someone that one knows is great. That there is a thing called greatness which makes a mark on a life that is never going to be lost. And I also wanted to really undo a kind of nostalgia about wasn't America great in the good old days. I really believe nostalgia is the handmaiden of fascism. And what I wanted to say was this very nice boy and his very nice family didn't get until Thomas Mann tells him that there were they were living, you know, anti-Semitically, that they were racist, and that they absolutely didn't care that Jews were being slaughtered. And so that was a kind of, to me, culpable innocence that I think Americans can be guilty of. And we're guilty of it in whitewashing the past, I think.
And we see those conflicts playing out right now in places like Ferguson.
Oh, my goodness, yes, where everybody thinks, you know, everything's fine.
The last novella, Fine Arts, is written from the perspective of Teresa Reardon, a 25-year-old graduate student of art history at Yale, whose world opens when she wins a grant to travel to Lucca to study the early Renaissance sculpture of Matteo Civitelli. Did you visit Lucca to see Civitelli's sculpture?
I have a very great friend, David Plant, to whom a wonderful writer to whom the book's dedicated, who has a home in Lucca, so I've been there a lot.
Now, Civitelli is not the most famous of the early Renaissance sculptors, and yet his work is quite fascinating, but very much associated with its locale in Lucca.
Exactly, and because he wasn't working in Florence or Naples or Rome, he's kind of stayed a local boy, but his work is in mainly in polychrome wooden sculpture, which is not, you know, the sexiest form, although I adore it. And so he has remained sort of a local secret.
Well, he also dies right before the Renaissance hits full swing with
exactly.
Masaccio. I think he died 1505 or
yes,
something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
Lots of writers have told me that they don't like to talk too much about what they're going to write next, but you've told people that you're already working on a new novel that's set during the Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
How's it going?
It's going. It's a dark time, a dark period.
Simone Weil make an appearance there as well?
No, but it was
or George
because,
Orwell?
No. Well, I'm not going to talk about George Orwell. Simone Weil was kind of my inspiration because she went to fight in the Spanish Civil War as an anarchist. Georges Bernanos wrote about the Spanish Civil War, and he was looking at it from the right. They both said, this is such a bloodbath that it is impossible to say right or wrong. She wrote to him and said, you're a royalist. I'm an anarchist. I thought you were my enemy. You're my brother. And they were the only two who could really see the bloodlust that motivated what was going on all sides. The communists, the anarchists, God knows the Francoists, who were armed by the Nazis and the fascists.
Well, it wasn't just a war between the loyalists and the fascists led by Franco. There was so much infighting within the defenders of the government there were like two or three internal wars going
exactly.
on at the same time.
It's so frustrating to see them wasting their very small resources fighting each other.
So are you driven by a sense of history? Because these stories all have to do with people dealing with the past in the present and looking at the significance of past historical figures.
Yes, I think that to be a postmodern is to have to rethink our relationship to the past in a radical way. And I'm calling this novel The Uses of the Past. So what do we do with the past when we know that we know it imperfectly? We can't have a fantasy anymore that what we remember is absolutely the case. So how do we live with that? How do we live with our imperfect knowledge, our fractured knowledge, and our knowledge of our imperfect knowledge? That fascinates me a lot. What is the myth of the past that moves us on, and how can we disentangle that knowing that we can't ever possibly do it?
Do you think of yourself as a postmodernist? Because you told an interviewer once that the most important writers to you were all modernist writers: Virginia Woolf, Ford Madox Ford, James Joyce, Henry James, and Catherine Ann Porter. And Porter's the only one who lived past the late 1940s.
Well, I don't think I'm whatever postmodernism means. I don't think I'm probably I think I'm stylistically more a modernist. But I think willy-nilly, we are all postmodernists, because what to be a postmodernist is to know that your knowledge is partial and that there are other ways of looking at things that you probably can't see that might be, if not absolutely equally valid, have to be taken into account. So I think to be postmodernist is to know that your knowledge is incomplete, and also to know that art, the kind of art that we love, is not at the center of the cultural conversation anymore. We can't imagine ourselves like Joyce as the new priesthood. We're just not anymore, and we have to know that.
Mary Gordon is the author of a number of award-winning books, including 7 novels. That include Final Payments, Pearl, and The Love of My Youth, 6 works of nonfiction, including the memoirs The Shadow Man and Circling My Mother, 3 collections of fiction, including The Stories of Mary Gordon, and now 4 novellas under the title The Liar's Wife. It is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Great. Always to be with you.
Thank you.